brainchild. The company's intellectual foundation was built from his expertise as a business process analyst and in expert systems. The process reengineering work appealed to Richard's sense of methodology and superior strategy, both developed through years of playing chess as a youth. Not only was Richard one of England's youngest chess champions, holding a master rating, but it was common knowledge throughout the company and typically the first thing people mentioned about Richard. Chess champion and Oxford University graduate. He was clearly a genius and the chief genius in the company. He doesn't just share his ideas, he sells them relentlessly and forcefully. While he thinks he's inspiring others, it is more like he's wearing them down and flogging people into submission. When he gave the title of CEO to someone else, everyone knew that Richard, who remained the chairman of the board, was still the one who called the shots on budget, pricing, products, compensation, and company strategy. An army of pawns. The energy changes in a room when Richard enters. It is as if the headmaster has entered the school assembly. People begin to shrink. People react the way they might when the calculus teacher gives a surprise oral quiz, getting smaller, hoping he or she won't call on them and find them lacking. Despite the fact that everyone fears the attention will turn to them, the attention often just stays with Richard, who works to make sure he is seen as the expert and the smartest person in the room. In one executive management meeting, Richard put the company general counsel in the hot seat with a pop quiz about a technical distinction on a very specific legal code regarding corporate governance. Richard had become concerned that his general counsel didn't fully understand the nuances of this particular code that had to be reported to the city. So he began launching questions. One by one, the general counsel answered them until the questions became more precise and delved into nuances and obscure scenarios. The general counsel looked puzzled, but answered the questions to the best of his knowledge. This didn't satisfy Richard, who left work in time to stop by a W.H. Smith bookshop just before it closed. He didn't buy just any governance book. He bought the 600-page manual on the most recently announced corporate governance codes. And he didn't just look up the answer to the question he'd asked. He stayed up through the night reading the entire book. The following day, he called a meeting of the executive team. The topic for this emergency management meeting was, of course, this particular code. Richard professed his newfound knowledge and quite publicly let everyone know everything the general counsel got wrong. Bad Bishop. Richard is a master of the gotcha. He only asks questions that he knows the answer to. He asks questions to test other people's knowledge and to make sure other people understand his point of view. One of his vice presidents said, "I can't think of a single time that he has asked a question when he didn't know the answer." He's also a master of the stall, which he uses when he doesn't have the answer himself. He is known for asking frivolous questions during teleconferences to stall the conversation while he Googles the answers to get ahead in the conversation. One such stall was during a meeting with an account team that was planning their sales proposal for a deal with British Telecom. The sales team was reviewing the proposed contract. Richard, who appeared not yet to know exactly how the contract should be worded, jumped in with, "How many of you have read British Telecom's field operations manual?" The document was 500 pages long and not your typical reading for a sales representative. Wondering if this was a trick question, the team tentatively confessed that they hadn't read it. Richard replied with, "How can you even understand this contract and sell to a BT if you haven't read the field operations manual?" The sales process came to a complete standstill while the entire account team, along with Richard, the founder and chairman of the board, read the manual. One team member said, "He wasn't the kind of leader who would say, 'I have an idea. Why don't we look in the manual to better understand the business and the terms of the contract?' Instead, he made us look ridiculous for not doing it." Fool's mate. It is no surprise when really smart, talented people don't stay long in this organization. Some are asked to leave when the founder finds out they aren't as smart as he'd like. Others quit and stay, giving up on the idea of making a meaningful contribution. The sharpest people leave because they see the wasted time and talent and know the organization can't grow beyond its founder. Although the company has been able to grow sales under Richard's leadership, most believe that the organization is inherently limited. They remark, "We'll never become a serious company." One of these two executives operated as a challenger. The other operated as a know-it-all. This chapter is about the difference. The know-it-all versus the challenger. The approach of these two executives captures the essential difference between how know-it-alls and challengers provide direction and pursue opportunities for their organization. Diminishers operate as know-it-alls, assuming that their job is to know the most and to tell their organization what to do. The organization often revolves around what they know, with people wasting cycles trying to deduce what the boss thinks and how to, at least, look like they're executing accordingly. In the end, diminishers place an artificial limit on what their organizations can accomplish. Because they are overly focused on what they know, they limit what their organization can achieve to what they themselves know how to do. In setting direction for their organizations, multipliers have a fundamentally different approach. Instead of knowing the answer, they play the role of the challenger. They use their smarts to find the right opportunities for their organizations and challenge and stretch their organizations to get there. They aren't limited by what they themselves know. They push their teams beyond their own knowledge and that of the organization. As a result, they create organizations that deeply understand challenge and have the focus and energy to confront it. The mind of a multiplier. What are the assumptions that lie at the heart of these different approaches? Consider our two CEOs. What caused Matt to challenge his organization in a way that allowed others to do their very best thinking and best work? And why did other people's intelligence and capability stagnate around Richard? We know that both executives are highly intelligent, with a clear vision for their organizations and a passion for their work. But if we examine their approach to setting direction, we can distinguish two different logics at work. Deeply embedded in Richard's logic is the assumption, "I need to have all the answers." He sees this as the essence of his job as a leader. And if he doesn't know the answers, he needs to either find them himself or appear to know the answers. What does he do when he doesn't have the answer? He stalls until he can find it. He buys a book on it. He reads the operations manual. He Googles the answer. He assumes his role is to know and to be the expert. It is an assumption that may have become entrenched in the years he studied expert systems. If a leader holds the assumption that it is their role to provide the answers, and if the employees resign themselves to this mode of business, a downward know-it-all spiral naturally follows. First, the leader provides all the answers. Second, subordinates wait for the directives they've come to expect. Third, the subordinates act on the leader's answers. Finally, the leader concludes, "They would never have figured this out without me." He or she sees evidence to support this belief and concludes, "It's obvious I need to tell others what to do." Matt's leadership at Gymboree follows a different logic. He uses his intellect and energy on two things. First, asking the bold question. And second, parsing the challenge into reasonable increments so the team can build intellectual muscle and the confidence that comes from clearing progressively higher bars. His assumption seems to be that people get smarter and stronger by being challenged. As people embrace the challenge, both their insights and the belief grows. Soon, the impossible begins to look possible. If leaders have to spread their intelligence across asking the questions and finding the answers, they tend to ask questions they already know the answer to. Once a leader accepts that he or she doesn't have all the answers, he or she is free to ask much bigger, more provocative, and frankly, more interesting questions. They can pursue things they don't know how to do. Let's look at another challenger in action. The challenger. By 1995, the Oracle Corporation was headquartered in the affluent waterfront neighborhood of Redwood Shores on the San Francisco Peninsula. Oracle had begun retooling its products for the internet, but the business strategy was still unclear. The challenge of figuring it out would fall to Ray Lane, Oracle's president, who had joined Oracle 2 years earlier and had grown the U.S. business from $571 million to $1.2 billion. Ray's revolution. Ray decided to gather the top 250 leaders of the company from across the globe in a series of forums to educate them on the corporate strategy and to align the leadership team behind this strategy. Ray and the other senior executives, including CEO Larry Ellison and CFO Jeff Henley, prepared their strategy presentations and gathered the first group of 30 executives. They gave their presentations and held discussions, but as the week went on, the group became more and more confused. One vice president spoke for the group when he said, "We aren't clear on the strategy. We just saw a lot of PowerPoint slides." Ray and his team went back to the drawing board and did a major overhaul of their presentations. Then they invited another group of 30 executives. This time the feedback was different. All-out revolt. One of the executives took a risk and said, "Stop getting people together until there is a clear strategy." The team was not buying what Ray and the rest of the team were selling. Independence Day. The senior executive team quickly regrouped at Ray's house on their first available day, the 4th of July. They realized the global business had become more complex and diverse than they originally thought, and that they couldn't build this strategy alone at corporate. So they decided to take a fundamentally different approach. Ray and the executive team had started out trying to tell others all the answers. Now, they switched to sharing the fundamental questions, trends, and assumptions that were shaping their views. When they came back together with the next forum of leaders, Ray and the other executives shared what they saw happening in the business and where they saw the world going. Ray seeded the opportunities that these trends would present for Oracle and presented a framework for a strategy, 4 key transformations needed in the business. And then with this broad stroke of his brush, he stopped telling and started asking, "Are these the transformations needed in the business? And which of our assumptions about the future might be wrong?" Ray gave the group a challenge to fill in the blanks. The team would have 2 days to examine each of the 4 transformations, identify milestones, and pinpoint the implications for the business, and then pass their thinking on to the next group of leaders who would go further. The group did exactly that, advancing the thinking of the executive team and then handing off their work to the next group of executives. The group reveled in their collective success and left the forum knowing that they had begun something big. The process continued until every senior vice president and vice president had been involved and each group had challenged the work that had been done before them. They took their task seriously, turning the strategy upside down and sideways as they looked for holes, logic flaws, and vulnerabilities. In the end, they emerged with both a validation and a refinement of the collective thinking. And momentum was still building. The convention. Ray and the other executives culminated this process by convening the entire leadership team of the company. The executive team unveiled the strategic intent of the organization and the transformations needed in the business. The reaction of the global leadership team was overwhelming enthusiasm and optimism, knowing they would be making business history. The strategy was fresh and compelling, Yet it was familiar to them because they had co-created it and could see their fingerprints on it. When the meeting was divided into regional breakouts, the scene was far from typical. Instead of discussion about why this won't work in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, or the EMEA region, the conversation in the EMEA breakout room was almost boisterous, with questions like, what is the first step? And where can we start implementing this in Germany? The scene in the Japanese breakout room said it all. They discussed the strategy and its implications for Japan, and then, with quiet fervor, began to organize as if they were going to battle. What was unveiled in the meeting and the breakout sessions was a manifestation and statement of the collective will of the organization. In the next 4 years, under Ray Lane and Larry Ellison's leadership, Oracle led the enterprise computing market and grew from $4.2 billion to $10.1 billion, more than doubling revenues. Ray Lane began with an honest attempt to sell a strategy to the organization. But he emerged a more powerful leader when he first seeded the opportunity, then laid down the stretch challenge for the organization. By doing this, he wasn't setting the direction. He was ensuring the direction was set and operating as a challenger. The three practices of the challenger. How does the challenger engage the full brain power of the organization? Among the multipliers we studied in our research, we found three common practices. Multipliers, number one, seed the opportunity. Number two, lay down a challenge. And number three, generate belief. We'll examine each in turn. Practice number one, seed the opportunity. Multipliers understand that people grow through challenge. They understand that intelligence grows by being stretched and tested. So even if the leader has a clear vision of the direction, he or she doesn't just give it to people. Multipliers don't give answers. Instead, they begin a process of discovery. They provide just enough information to provoke thinking and to help people discover and see the opportunity for themselves. We'll outline a few of the ways that multipliers seed opportunity and begin the discovery process. Show the need. One of the best ways to seed an opportunity is to allow someone else to discover it for themselves. When people can see the need for themselves, they develop a deep understanding of the issues, and quite often, all the leader needs to do is get out of their way and let them solve the problem. The Benyon Center on the University of Utah campus was established to encourage students to engage in community service projects and activism while in college. Irene Fisher, the center's director for 14 years, was hopeful that the students would sign up for some of the city's toughest problems. Instead of making a speech or just selling her vision of service to the poorest members of the community, Irene invited students to take a leadership position and organize other students to work with a community. She took them downtown into the inner city community so they could see the issues for themselves. They walked the streets and observed the plight of the homeless. They visited shelters and talked with single mothers struggling to get by. Because they saw the needs for themselves, they became passionate and curious about how to create change and learned quickly in the process. As their involvement grew, these student leaders assumed more and more challenging roles. She noted, "University students are pretty smart. Once they see something, they start asking questions. Our students asked a lot of questions and then went to work." Irene seeded the opportunity and allowed the students to take the challenge. Irene added, "I don't see myself as a challenger per se. I think of creating the opportunity for people to see the challenge so they can respond to it." The Benyon Center is still thriving today, built on the assumption that you don't get the most out of people if you just tell them what to do. You get full effort if you help people discover opportunity and then challenge themselves. Challenge the assumptions. Multipliers ask the questions that challenge the fundamental assumptions in an organization and disrupt the prevailing logic. Renowned management guru and strategy professor C.K. Prahalad was known for asking the questions that challenged the fundamental assumptions of an organization. He understood that strategy is about understanding and questioning assumptions. When working with management teams in leading corporations, C.K. had a penchant for asking the unsettling questions that rattled their assumptions and enabled them to see market opportunities and threats in a different light. In working with the Philips Corporation, a multinational manufacturing company, and after carefully interviewing each member of the executive team to uncover their core assumptions about the business and the tensions in the organization, he could see that they had assumed invincibility in the market. C.K. formulated a plan. When he arrived at their executive strategy offsite, he began with a fictitious article he'd written that might appear in the New York Times, forecasting a bankruptcy at Philips. He then launched the following questions. What changes in the current competitive landscape would devastate Philips' revenue stream? What if companies A and B merged? What market changes could lead to a bankruptcy? What is your game plan if it happens? The room became ominously silent. He had shaken their beliefs upon which the current business strategy was based. With the full interest of the executive team, he guided the discussion as they began to explore the answers. Reframe problems. Multipliers understand the power of an opportunity. As Peter Block, consulting guru and author, observed, the most powerful work is done in response to an opportunity, not in response to a problem. Multipliers analyze problems, but they also reframe them to show the opportunity presented by the challenges. Consider how Alan G. Laffey, when he was CEO of Procter & Gamble, reframed the problems of generating revenue growth from new product R&D as part of his overall revitalization of the company. As Larry Houston and Nabil Saqab explain in their Harvard Business Review article, Connect and Develop, the invented themselves model was no longer allowing P&G to sustain a high level of top-line growth. At $25 billion, the company could still manage to do it, but beyond $50 billion, it was impossible, and P&G lost half of their market cap as their stock fell from $118 to $52 a share. Rather than falling into the trap of doing more of the same, Laffey developed a new strategy of sourcing their innovation from the outside. The shift was from not invented here to proudly invented elsewhere. Rather than thinking of innovation as invention, where the R&D has to be done in your own physical labs, Laffey looked for ways to join forces with people in their supply chain, whom they could partner with to innovate more rapidly. For example, Houston and Saqab relate when the idea emerged to produce Pringles potato chips with pictures and words printed on the crisps themselves, P&G had to decide whether to create an end-to-end solution from scratch or whether to find an innovative solution somewhere within their partner network. In the past, bringing a new product to market represented a 2-year investment, but with Laffey's new reframe, they could see a smarter path. In the case of the Pringles, they created a technology brief that defined the problems they needed to solve, and they circulated it throughout their global networks of individuals and institutions to discover if anyone in the world had a ready-made solution. It was through their European network that they discovered a small bakery in Bologna, Italy, run by a university professor who also manufactured baking equipment. The professor's innovation allowed P&G to get to market in half the time and at a fraction of the cost of inventing the solutions in-house. The product was an immediate hit that led the Pringles division to enjoy double-digit growth for the next 2 years. Create a starting point. Multipliers provide a starting point, but not a complete solution. In this way, they generate more questions than answers. These questions then encourage their team to fully define the opportunity while giving them confidence that they're building on a solid foundation. Ray Lane and Oracle's top executives created the skeleton of a strategic framework and then asked groups of senior leaders to work systematically and collaboratively to complete the whole strategy. When a challenger has successfully seeded an opportunity, other people can see the opportunity for themselves. And because the opportunity has been planted, but is not fully grown, others are taken through a process of discovery. This process of exploration and discovery sparks intellectual curiosity and begins to generate energy for the challenge. The answers are not clear yet, so people know there's still something for me to do, and they feel motivated to step in and be involved. Practice number two, lay down a challenge. Once an opportunity is seeded and the intellectual energy is created, multipliers establish the challenge at hand in such a way that it creates a huge stretch for the organization. While diminishers create a huge gap between what they know and what other people know, multipliers create a space between what people know and what they need to know, and that draws people into the challenge. They establish a compelling challenge that creates tension. People see the tension and the size of the stretch and are intrigued and perhaps even puzzled. How does a multiplier achieve this level of stretch without breaking an organization? How do you create intrigue rather than apprehension? In our research, we found that multipliers achieve this energizing stretch in three ways. First, they extend a clear and concrete challenge. Then, they ask the hard questions that need to be answered to achieve the challenge. But most importantly, they don't answer them. They let others fill in the blanks. Extend a concrete challenge. Sean Mendy is the Senior Director of Development at Boys and Girls Clubs of the Peninsula. Sean previously oversaw the club's after-school program in East Palo Alto, California, a city that in 1992 had the highest per capita murder rate in the United States and where dropping out of high school is a norm. Sean himself faced many challenges growing up, but went on to attend and graduate from Cornell University and then earned graduate degrees from Stanford University and the University of Southern California. With a journey like Sean's, he has ample reason to tell the teens he works with what they need to do to succeed. But instead of telling, he challenges. When Sean first met Tajiana Robinson, or Taji, she was a shy and hesitant 12-year-old. When she reluctantly shook his outstretched hand, he stopped her and with a big smile said, "You know, there are three things you might want to do when you meet someone. First, look them in the eye. Second, give them a firm hand. Third, shake their hand up and down three full times." Taji was appalled, but intrigued. Sean continued to extend small, specific challenges to her. He asked Taji if she would take a newspaper class. She did. Then he encouraged her to write a main article for the school paper, meet regularly with a writing tutor, and learn how to write a great essay. Again, she did. Next, he encouraged her to raise the bar and compete in her school's Scholar of the Year competition. She won. Sean extends these challenges by asking youths hard questions and then giving them the space to think and respond. As Taji put it, "He taught me to think for myself." This allows Taji and others to strengthen intellectual muscles and build the confidence they need to tackle the hardest challenges. Early on with Taji, Sean looked her in the eye and asked, "If you could get out of this environment, what would you do?" There was a long silence. Finally, Taji said, "I'd go to college." Sean responded, "What would it take for you to do that?" After several moments of reflection, her eyes lit up and she said, "I'd need to get into the right high school." They set a goal for Taji to earn a scholarship to one of the top-tier prep schools in the surrounding area. Sean asked, "Where should we start?" Taji led the process, but together they figured out which schools would be the best fit. They completed applications and prepared for her high school interviews. The night before one of the biggest interviews, Taji's family left her at home to do her homework while they went out for a drive. As the family pulled up to a stop sign, a gunman approached the car, firing multiple bullets into the vehicle that was transporting three small children. Taji's older cousin was shot in the back, and her six-year-old sister was shot in the leg. Nobody died, but it was traumatic in every conceivable way. The next morning, Sean suggested Taji might want to reschedule the high school interview they had planned. But through her emotion, she yelled, "This is how I'm going to get out of here. This is what I need to do to have the kind of life I want, and this is how I can help my family and make sure it doesn't happen again." She wiped her tears, went to the interview, and blew away everyone she met. Tajiana was accepted to four competitive preparatory schools, earning full scholarships to each. Taji grew into a resilient, motivated, bright young teen, attended Sacred Heart, a private school in Atherton, California, and is now in college. Out of the 17 students in Sean's eighth grade program, 12 have received scholarships to prestigious prep schools, and the other five have entered rigorous college track programs. Sean served as a challenger, helping these youth raise their aspiration level and build the mental agility they would need to get and stay on a course of success. Whether it is Matt McCauley at Gymboree extending the $2 challenge or Sean Mendy issuing a college-bound challenge, our research showed that multipliers use their intelligence to make challenges concrete for others. These challenges become tangible and measurable, allowing people to assess their performance. By making a challenge real, they allow others to visualize the achievement and communicate the confidence that the organization has the collective brain power required. This confidence is essential because the challenge will demand that the entire organization extend itself beyond its current reach and capability. Ask the hard questions. Diminishers give answers. Good leaders ask questions. Multipliers ask the really hard questions. They ask the questions that challenge people not only to think, but to rethink. They ask questions so immense that people can't answer them based on their current knowledge or where they currently stand. To answer these questions, the organization must learn. Enabled by these big questions, a vacuum is created in the space between what people know and what they need to know, and a vacuum between what they can currently do and what they need to be able to do. This vacuum creates a deep tension in the organization and raises a need to reduce that tension. It's like a rubber band that is stretched to its limit. One side needs to move towards the other to reduce the tension. Matt McCauley at Gymboree created this forward poll when he asked each member of his organization, "What is your mission impossible?" By establishing this tension, it became impossible to stay in the same place. Let others fill in the blanks. How do multipliers get people to step into a challenge? They shift the burden of thinking to others. Initially, when they establish a concrete challenge, the burden of thinking sits with them as the leader. By asking the hard questions and inviting others to fill in the blanks, they are shifting the burden of thinking onto their people. The onus now sits with their team to understand the challenge and find a solution. In this shift, the multiplier creates intelligence and energy around him or herself. After assuming leadership of a new division in a large consumer electronics company in Korea, the CEO called his management team together and informed them of his goals to be number one in the market and to become a magnet company attracting top college graduates. He was clear that the trajectory for the organization would not be incremental. He had a vision of something big. He then engaged a broad array of stakeholders in analyzing how to achieve the number one position. The coalition included key executives, founding family members, and outside consultants. Assembling the coalition, he seeded the opportunity and posed the difficult questions, such as, Why are we in this business? And do we deserve to be in this business? And what would it take to be better than our competition? These questions cut to the bone of the organization and stirred up chaos. Yet he never backed down. The tension forced the team to generate answers. He asked the hard questions and then let the team fill in the blanks. As they did, he maintained a tight time frame. He said, "I don't need 100% answers. I need a 30% answer in 2 days. Give me a 30% answer so we can talk about it and decide if it makes sense for you to find a 50% answer. And if we get there, we'll block 2 months to get a 100% answer." In the end, there were clear answers. The process took months and was scrappy, but it built the intellectual muscle and energy the organization needed for the challenge. Laying down a challenge means more than directing people to do it. It includes asking the hard questions that no one yet has the answer to, and then backing off so that the people within the organization have the space to think through the questions, take ownership, and find answers. When a multiplier has successfully laid down the challenge, people see the stretch, are intrigued, and become intellectually engaged. The burden of thinking has been shifted to the organization. This process of ownership and stretch continues to build energy by creating the intellectual muscle for the challenge. Practice number 3, generate belief. By seeding the opportunity and laying down a challenge, people are interested in what is possible. But this isn't enough to create movement. Multipliers generate belief, the belief that the impossible is actually possible. It isn't enough that people see and understand the stretch. They need to actually stretch themselves. The following are a few ways we discovered that multipliers produce this belief in their organizations. Helicopter down. One way multipliers generate belief is by taking the challenge down to the ground level. K.R. Sridhar, CEO of Bloom Energy, whose vision is to produce power generators for homes and businesses at half the carbon emissions of traditional power generators, explains, "The direction needs to be improbable, but not impossible. It can't just exist at 30,000 feet. It has to be at the 1,000-foot level. It's irresponsible to ask your team to do something if the CEO exposure is only at the 30,000-foot level. You have to take it down and show that it can be done. You have to show them a pathway and show why it can be done. You only need to do this once to create the belief." By helicoptering down to reality, multipliers create a meaningful proof point that a bold challenge can be successfully met. Co-create the plan. When people create the plan that they eventually will implement, belief in its viability will be inherently high. Led by Ray Lane in 1996, Oracle not only built a strategic intent, it also built a deep belief within the organization that Oracle could lead the internet era. Because 250 senior leaders were given the opportunity to co-create the corporate strategy, they understood the challenge ahead and knew what actions would be necessary to achieve it. They had built the collective will and energy needed to execute. The organization was ready to take the challenge. Orchestrate an early win. Sometimes the temptation exists for leaders to tackle too many problems at once. Our research showed that multipliers begin with small, early wins and use those to generate belief toward the greater stretch challenges. Consider Nobel Prize winner Wangari Maathai, who passed away in 2011. In her words, "I was hearing many Nairobi women complain that they didn't have enough firewood. They were also complaining that they didn't have enough water. Why not plant trees?" I asked them. And so they just started, very, very, very small. And before too long, they started showing each other. Communities began empowering each other to plant trees for their own needs. From just 7 original trees planted by Wangari on June 5th, 1977, on World Environment Day, the Greenbelt Movement has successfully planted more than 40 million trees in Africa. And of course, the movement goes beyond trees. Wangari has written, "Many people don't understand that the tree is just an entry point. It is an easy point. Because it is something that people understand. It is something people can do. It is not very expensive to do it, and you don't need too much technology to do it. But once we get into the community through tree planting, we deal with a lot of other issues. We deal with issues of governance, issues of human rights, issues of conflicts and peace, and issues of long-term resource management. Senior leaders in corporations can generate belief about significant challenges by orchestrating small, early wins. When the multiplier has generated belief in what is possible, the weight shifts and the organization is willing to leave the realm of the known and venture into the unknown." The Academy Award-winning documentary Man on Wire chronicles the feat of renowned high-wire artist Philippe Petit in 1974 as he walked a tightrope stretched 140 feet across the expanse between the 1,368-foot-high twin towers of the World Trade Center in New York City. In the movie, Petit explains the moment of truth when he stood on the edge of one tower with his back foot on the building and his front foot on the cable. He said, "I had to make a decision of shifting my weight from one foot anchored to the building to the foot anchored on the wire. This is probably the end of my life to step on that wire. On the other hand, something I could not resist called me up on the cable." I have seen this shift of weight happen many times inside of organizations. You can almost feel the energy of the organization begin to tip in a new direction. This shift happens when an individual or organization has fully embraced a challenge and has generated the belief in what is possible. It is not the multiplier who whips up this belief. Rather, it is the challenge he or she has issued that generates this commitment. This challenge process builds the intellectual muscle, the emotional energy, and the collective intent to move forward. Multipliers orchestrate the process needed to shift the weight of an organization. The diminisher's approach to setting direction. In contrast to multipliers, diminishers have a fundamentally different approach to providing direction. Instead of using their intelligence to enable people to stretch toward a future opportunity, they give directions in a way that showcases their superior knowledge. Instead of seeding an opportunity and laying out a believable challenge, diminishers tell and test. Like the stereotypical know-it-all, they tell people what they know, tell people how to do their jobs, and test other people's knowledge to see if they are doing it right. Telling what they know. Diminishers consider themselves thought leaders and readily share their knowledge. However, they rarely share it in a way that invites contribution. They tend to sell their ideas rather than learning what other people know. One manager in Europe took up all the oxygen in the room by talking endlessly about his ideas. A peer said of him, "He is so busy sharing what he thinks, there's no space for anyone else." A direct report added this insight: "I have worked in the same department with him for 10 years, and he has never asked me a question. Not once, not ever. I have occasionally heard him ask a question to the universe. I wonder why we do X. But even then, he fills the silence with his own thoughts about the answer." Testing what you know. When diminishers do actually engage others, it's no surprise that they want to verify that you understand what they know. They ask questions to make a point rather than to access greater insight or to generate collective learning. Like Richard Palmer, the founder discussed earlier, they are masters at the gotcha question. Diminishers leave people stressed but unstretched. Telling people how to do their jobs. Rather than shift responsibility to other people, diminishers stay in charge and tell others in detail how to do their jobs. They assume the senior thinker posture, giving themselves permission to generate both the questions and the answers. One such diminisher was Chip Maxwell, an executive producer on a major motion picture production set. Despite the fact that the director had carefully assembled a world-class team of talent, Chip was constantly interfering in the team's work, routinely bypassing the director to tell his staff exactly how to do their jobs. The director of photography abruptly resigned in the middle of filming, claiming that if Chip seemed to know how to light the shot better than he did, then maybe he could be the DP. This award-winning DP knew the number of lights needed, and he certainly knew where to put them. He also knew his talents could be better used on another film. Diminishers often unintentionally shut down the intelligence of others. Most diminishers have built their careers on their own expertise and have been rewarded for their superior knowledge. For many, it's not until they reach a career plateau or crisis, or the director of photography quits in the middle of filming, that they begin to recognize that their base assumptions are inaccurate and are limiting themselves and others. A colleague of mine recently took an IQ test and received a score of 144. He was exuberant and claimed that he was just 1 point shy of certified genius status. No doubt he was envisioning his welcome letter from Mensa. On learning of our research, his enthusiasm became a bit dampened. He said, "Wow, I've worked all my life to prove I'm a genius, and just at the point that I can say that I am, I learned that it doesn't even matter anymore." Of course, this is only half right. Raw mental horsepower is still relevant. But the most powerful leaders are those who not only have this mental horsepower themselves, but also know how to multiply it by accessing and stretching other people's intelligence. Consider the difference between a leader who yearns for an additional IQ point to take their IQ to 145, official genius level, and leaders who use their intelligence to add an IQ point to every person in their organization. What could your organization accomplish if every person became effectively 1 point smarter? There are times when a leader is so knowledgeable and personally brilliant that it seems tempting for them to provide directives centered in what they know. However, in the end, know-it-alls limit what their organization can achieve to what they themselves know how to do. Under their leadership, the organization never leverages its full intelligence, and the true capacity of the organization is idled away or becomes consumed by the fire drill of figuring out what the boss thinks. Diminishers create idle cycles. A highly intelligent vice president at a major global technology firm was accustomed to a fast-paced and demanding environment. He was a competitor in the market who never stopped challenging himself and others. However, after transferring to a division led by a classic know-it-all, he found himself idle most of the time. He said, "I spent most of my time waiting for my boss to make decisions. In the meantime, I can't do much else. I'm essentially working part-time. I'm bored, but I'm enjoying taking sailing lessons." This vice president was ready for high-speed battle, but was relegated to easy sailing. In contrast, multipliers create rapid cycles. By playing the challenger instead of the know-it-all, they access more brains, get those brains working faster, and earn the full discretionary effort of their people. Once they have a clear view of latent opportunities and challenges, they understand that there are no resources worthy of waste. Under the direction of challengers, teams are able to accelerate their performance. Because the organization does not have to wait for the leader to think of it first, they can solve tougher problems at an accelerated rate. Because people understand the context, they can act for themselves rather than wait to be told or approved. Because they're encouraged to be smarter than the leader, people can stop competing for idea validation and instead commit themselves to the challenge. And the result is that intelligence grows individually and collectively. The collective intent built within the organization enables the whole group to break through challenges no single leader, however intelligent, could have done alone. This understanding leads to a key question. How does someone provide direction like Matt McCauley at Gymboree or Ray Lane at Oracle? How does someone go from a know-it-all to a challenger? Becoming a challenger. Challengers start with developing their overactive imagination and a serious case of curiosity. In our research, we analyzed how multipliers and diminishers were rated against 48 leadership practices. It is not surprising that the highest rated practice for multipliers was intellectual curiosity. Multipliers create genius in others because they're fundamentally curious and spark learning in those around them. The question why is at the core of their thinking and takes the form of an insatiable need for deep organizational understanding. Challengers are multipliers who ponder possibilities. They want to learn from people around them. At the heart of any challenge is intellectual curiosity. I wonder if we could do the impossible. When deeply rooted in a mindset of curiosity, one is ready to begin working as a challenger. Here are several starting points. The starting block. Experiment number one, take the extreme questions challenge. Most executives are barraged with questions, constantly responding to others seeking their opinion. The nature of the executive role makes it easy to stay rooted in answer mode and to be the boss. A bad leader will tell people what to do. A good leader will ask questions that let his or her people figure out the answers. A great leader asks the questions that focus the intelligence of their team on the right problems. The first step in this journey is to stop answering questions and begin asking them. Several years ago, I was commiserating with a colleague at work about our parenting challenges. Brian also had several small children, so he was simpatico as I lamented that I had become a bossy mom, constantly telling my kids what to do and barking orders. I detailed the typical evening at my house. Get ready for bed. Stop that. Leave her alone. Pick up your toys. Put on your pajamas. Brush your teeth. Go back and use toothpaste this time. Story time. Get into bed. Back to bed. No, not my bed, your bed. Okay, now go to sleep. Now, I wasn't looking for advice. This was purely recreational complaining. But Brian offered an interesting challenge. He said, Liz, why don't you go home tonight and try speaking to your children only in the form of questions? No statements, no directives, no orders, just questions. Now, I quickly countered, but this is impossible. I'll be home by 6 o'clock tonight, and I can't get them to go to sleep until 9:30. That's 3.5 hours. Brian assured me that he understood and reiterated the challenge. No statements, just questions. As I drove home, I became more intrigued and decided I would take the challenge to the extreme. Everything I said would be a legitimate question. I summoned strength, opened the door, and began the experiment. Dinner and playtime were interesting. When it got close to bedtime, I looked at my watch and asked my children, "What time is it?" One responded, "It's bedtime." I continued, "So what do we do to get ready for bed?" They explained, "We get our pajamas on." "Okay, who needs help?" The 2-year-old did, so I helped him while the girls got themselves dressed for bed. "What's next?" I asked. Their responses showed remarkable understanding of the bedtime routine and an eagerness to act. Soon their teeth were brushed. "What story will we read tonight? And whose turn is it to pick the story? And who's going to read it?" After story time, I asked, "Who is ready for bed?" Eagerly, they said their prayers and they hopped into bed. And they stayed there. And then nodded off to sleep. Now, I stood in the hallway in shock and wondered, have I just witnessed a miracle? And what has happened to my children? And how long have they actually known how to do this? I was intrigued by this dramatic change in our home. So I continued the experiment a couple more nights. Yes, I did return to a more balanced pattern of communication, but not before the experiment had a profound and permanent shift on the way that I led. When I moved out of the mode of giving the answers and started asking the questions, I discovered that my kids knew how to do a lot of things that I had been doing for them. I decided to try it at work. I began asking questions like, "What do you think might go wrong?" or "How can we solve this problem?" As I began to tell less and ask more, I found that my management team was even smarter than I previously had seen. Most of the time, they didn't need me telling them what to do. They needed me to ask an intelligent question. I learned that the best leaders ask questions and let other people find the answers. Take the extreme question challenge and shift from know-it-all into challenger mode. Start with 100%. Try it at home. You might find your children or your housemates are good guinea pigs and great teachers. At work, take the first step by finding a meeting that you could lead solely with questions. You might be surprised at what people around you already know. If you're concerned this extreme approach will seem abrupt or strange, let your team know that you're experimenting with a new approach. While taking the extreme question challenge is a useful exercise for disrupting existing patterns of behavior, it's not intended to be a permanent mode of operating. Once you've developed a greater ability and propensity to lead through questions, you can strike an appropriate balance between inquiry and advocacy, especially one that is in harmony with your national culture. Experiment number 2, create a stretch challenge. Engage your team by giving them a mission impossible, a hard, concrete challenge that will stretch them and develop new capabilities. Identify a major challenge and start the team by getting specific. Make it an intriguing puzzle by detailing the constraints such as, how do we accomplish X by Y date with only Z resources available to us? Then stand back and let your team solve the puzzle. When leaders offer a challenge and then create a culture of belief, the organization steps up. People contribute beyond what they thought they could. Your team will likely report the experience as exhausting, but totally exhilarating, and will want to sign up for another stretch. Experiment number 3, take a bus trip. University of Michigan professor Noel Tishy tells a story about an executive at GE who found a creative way to seed a challenge and help his organization see a need in the marketplace. When Tom Tiller took over the failing appliance division at GE, the division was losing money, slashing its workforce, and hadn't released a new product in years. Tom loaded 40 people from his management team onto a rented bus and headed for the Atlanta Kitchen and Bath Show. The group was to find trends and needs and generate new product ideas that would keep the plant alive. The group developed a new line of products and turned around the division from a staggering loss to a $10 million profit. There are several ways to take a bus trip. Irene Fisher of the Benyon Center took people into the inner city so they could see the needs of the poor firsthand. As a corporate manager, you might visit a customer's factory floor to watch how a customer actually uses your product. You can take your team down to the local mall to watch people shop. But take that bus or van or train trip together. Help people see the need that must be met. Make it a learning experience that will reveal that need, create energy, and ignite a fire within your organization. Experiment number 4. Take a massive baby step. The corporate world has a plethora of terms for this. Creating an early win, delivering a symbolic victory, and the favorite, picking the low-hanging fruit. The problem is that most leaders do this in isolation. They pick a small group to run a pilot, which catches the attention of management, but doesn't have the visibility to get the attention of the entire organization. Instead, do it en masse. Make it visible. Create a conference room pilot for a new technology and hold an open house. Win back an important customer through the efforts of a cross-functional task force. Get the entire organization to take a small first step. But do it together so everyone can see the results and start to believe that something great is possible. This belief is what will shift the weight of the organization out onto that high wire. A good stretch. Jimmy Carter said,